WHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franson, together with my special guest host, Mark Edwards. Welcome, Mark.
Morning. This is my first time to host, so bear with me here. And I drove through that fog this morning from Boone, so I'm a little fuzzy.
But such dedication is great. But I have to tell people why Pat Schlarbaum, who actually recorded the interviews that we're going to be talking about, isn't here. And that's because he had to get up at 3:30 to drive down to his farm to get some work done before winter. So thanks for coming in.
Yeah, you bet. I'm looking forward to it.
You have a unique background from the years in the Department of Natural Resources, which is the last stop for this hearing, for the decision on the supervisors' meeting on Tuesday. And I thought you would bring a special perspective, and I'm sure that's going to happen. We need to start off now with Dennis Hart.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here again on this Friday. Let's start the way we usually do, with what made news in last Saturday's Ames Tribune. One of the stories involved an Iowa State University graduate and novelist who received a prestigious award. M. Molly Backus was one of 27 artists who received the award from the Tulsa Arts Fellowship. Each recipient received $20,000, plus a year's worth of free housing in Tulsa, a workspace, and other benefits. Backus received her master's degree from Iowa State's Creative Writing and Environment Program last spring. She received the Tulsa Award after applying with excerpts from her young adult novel, The Princesses of Iowa, which is about a high school homecoming princess whose life turns upside down overnight. Saturday's Trib also reported that two new outdoor ice skating rinks, one for casual use and one for hockey, will open in Ames with a ribbon-cutting ceremony next Wednesday, December 19th. The rinks are located at 1200 East 13th Street. They were donated by the Iowa Wild Hockey Team and Wells Fargo Bank. There is no fee to use either rink, but skaters will have to bring their own equipment. Ames is one of five cities in Iowa to have a community rink donated to it by the Iowa Wild and by Wells Fargo. Saturday's paper also had word that paving work on Story County's two main trails, Prairie Rail Trail in the north and Heart of Iowa in the south, is set to take place next year. The Prairie Rail Trail is about 11 miles of trail connecting the towns of Roland and McCallsburg. The Heart of Iowa Trail connects the communities along the south side of Story County, Slater, Huxley, Cambridge, Maxwell, and Collins. There was also word that a 2007 graduate of Nevada High School plans to become a full-time family physician with Story County Medical Center next year. 29-year-old Audra Podarucha is now a family medicine resident doctor at Broadlawns Medical Center in Des Moines. She said she's looking forward to the variety of things she'll do at Story Medical. And one more note from Saturday's paper, this one involving crime. Trial for a Boone man accused of sexually abusing a preteen girl for more than a year has been scheduled for January 15th in Story County. 32-year-old Roger Christopher McGee was arrested last August. If he's convicted, he faces up to 42 years in prison. Sunday's Tribune featured a heartwarming story reporting that the aisles in Target were filled with children early Saturday morning in Ames, kids eager to fill shopping carts with everything on their holiday shopping lists. It was the annual Shop with a Cop event, a partnership between police and the Boys and Girls Club of Story County. More than 40 officers helped children from 43 families as they checked off item by item on their shopping list. They had all gotten up early and had boarded Sci-Ride buses, which took them to the store. Afterward, they all boarded Sci-Ride buses again for the trip back to the Boys and Girls Club, where they either wrapped their newly purchased gift or put them into gift bags, then shared breakfast together. Sunday's paper also reported on a documentary-style podcast being put together commemorating the 50th anniversary of a plane crash near Story City. It took place December 9, 1968, when an Iowa Air National Guard F-89 Scorpion fighter jet crashed and exploded into flames just off Interstate 35 near Story City. The two crewmen were killed, and a farmhouse was set on fire. Now the farm owner's granddaughter is spearheading the effort to document what happened. Sunday's Tribune also had several photos from Saturday's annual Tuba Christmas concert at the First United Methodist Church in Ames. And there was a feature story about preparations underway in Cambridge, where the Snyder family was getting set for a big Christmas celebration that's been taking place in the family home for a half century. The home, by the way, was built in 1878. The Trib is not published on Mondays. Tuesday's paper reported that the Ames School Board saw a revised schematic design of the new high school building project during Monday's meeting. For the lower level, there were no changes from the plan to have a physical education area, competition court, locker rooms, and a pool. The first level will still feature the original entrance and academic pods. For the second floor, the media room, library, and academic pods remain the same. The current budget for the project is about $137 million. Ames voters approved a $110 million bond issue in April for construction of the new high school and expansion of three of the district's elementary schools. The district's physical plant and equipment levy and sales tax revenue will help cover the difference. Tuesday's paper also reported that for the past few weeks, the city of Ames has had multiple water main breaks, but those breaks have not caused more than an inconvenience for residents who have been affected. A city spokeswoman said water main breaks are common this time of year because the underground infrastructure is affected when the ground freezes and thaws. After water main breaks are repaired, residents can see a fluctuation in water pressure and even rusty water. The change in water color is not dangerous, and it can be flushed from a residence by running cold tap water. But rusty water can still stain clothing. There was also word on Tuesday that Iowa 4th Congressional District Democratic candidate J.D. Scholten had raised more than $1.5 million in the final weeks of his unsuccessful campaign to defeat Republican incumbent Steve King, and that Scholten outspent King by a 4-1 margin during that time. King wound up defeating Scholten by a bit more than 10,000 votes. Tuesday's paper also had word that a man who pleaded guilty to charges of abusing multiple children had written a letter to the judge asking that his plea be overturned and asking for a new trial. 30-year-old Michael Travis Ferguson had pleaded guilty to 5 counts of lascivious acts with a child as part of a plea agreement. Ferguson had been arrested in early October after police received multiple reports of children who allegedly had been sexually abused by Ferguson at Hickory Grove Park near Colo. Now he claims he was not told of all the possible consequences in making his plea, and he's asking for a new lawyer. Tuesday's paper also had word that Iowa State University and its football coach, Matt Campbell, had agreed on a contract extension through the year 2024. The university also agreed to provide Campbell with an additional $1 million for his assistant coaches and staff. Wednesday's Tribune reported that the Story County Board of Supervisors voted Tuesday to recommend approval for construction of 3 hog confinement operations north of Nevada. The vote was 2-1 in favor of recommending approval to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, the state agency that has authority over large animal feeding operations. Supervisor Loris Olson voted no. More than 100 residents attended Tuesday's meeting, many of them there to oppose the hog confinement plan. Scott Henry, one of the 3 brothers behind the proposal, spoke first, telling the crowd that his family would do what he called the absolute best to manage the facilities. But most of those who spoke after that expressed reservations about the plan, expressing concerns such as water quality issues and possible particulate matter coming from the confinements. Wednesday's paper also reported that voters in the Ballard School District had overwhelmingly approved a nearly $20 million bond issue in an election on Tuesday. The bond needed 60% approval to pass. It received 73%. The vote means major improvements are on the way for the district's middle school, enhanced security at elementary schools in Cambridge and Slater, and improvements to the stadium. The district enrolls 1,750 students from Huxley, Slater, Cambridge, and Kelly. And Wednesday's Tribune also had a story reflecting the spirit of this holiday season. It reported that 17 children from the Beloit Residential Treatment Center in Ames were the honored guests at Wilson Toyota on Tuesday night. They were there as part of a partnership between the dealership and Lutheran Services in Iowa, which operates Beloit Center. Each child at Beloit got to make a Christmas wish list, and that list was given to a Wilson employee who adopted the child for the holiday season. Each employee was then given a gift card to buy gifts for the children. At Tuesday night's event, Santa was there, of course, along with an elf and Frosty the Snowman. Thursday's Tribune, yesterday's, had word that the Iowa State Auditor issued a report on the investigation it conducted into the Collins Maxwell School District's former middle school and high school principal, Jordan Nelson, and his use of a district procurement card. The auditor's office identified nearly $15,000 of improper and unsupported disbursements and undeposited collections. Of that amount, nearly $9,000 was connected to Nelson, and the remaining money was the result of actions taken by other district employees. Nelson had served as a principal in the district since 2015 and was about to take over as superintendent before he suddenly resigned last June. Yesterday's paper also reported that the victim testified in the trial of an Ankeny man accused of installing a camera in a private room at his Ames workplace. Authorities said 35-year-old Ryan Edward Rock installed the camera so he could watch a co-worker breast pump. And in another trial, a Boone County jury found a Boone County man guilty of 8 counts of sexual abuse. 69-year-old Randall John Bielefeldt was convicted 6 months after a victim reported that Bielefeldt sexually abused her and two other minors. He faces up to 140 years in prison. Thursday's Trib also reported that the City of Ames had received the Distinguished Budget Presentation Award. The award was given by the Government Finance Officers Association. For the city to receive it, it has to meet nationally recognized guidelines for effective budget presentation. And yesterday's paper also had word that local teenagers brought a joyful noise to the halls of the Story County Department of Human Services building on Wednesday afternoon. A dozen members of a YSS group called Achieving Maximum Potential sang Christmas songs at the building. It was a new project that let AMP youth give back to the community by singing Christmas carols in exchange for donations of canned goods, all of which will be donated to the food pantry at Food at First. And that is your summary of the week's news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'm Dennis Hart. I'll be right back here on Monday with a look at what happened this week around the state of Iowa. In the meantime, I hope you have a safe and healthy and great weekend.
In case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. This is Susan Franzen, one of your hosts for today, together with my guest host, Mark Edwards. We've just heard the news from the Ames Tribune as condensed for us by Dennis Hart.
Well, we introduced at the start of the program the topic for today and reflections on last Tuesday's Story County Board of Supervisors meeting, which was real exciting because there was well over 100 people there. So there was a lot going on.
Yeah, I think the paper said 100, but several other people who were there said, no, more like 130, 100.
A lot of people came and couldn't get in and left.
The reason I invited you to come was because I knew that you had worked at the DNR for many years. And really, I guess when we talked a little more, I learned that you were really there at the beginning. So tell about your first knowledge of confined animal feeding.
Having an interest in, you know, the natural resources and the outdoors in Iowa, I was at that time working at Ledge State Park, and one of the first big CAFOs came in, Standard Premium came in, and it was digging the pits to less than a half a mile from the park. And so that kind of raised some concerns, and then I lived just about a mile south of it on the other side of the thing, and I was kind of growing concerned, and then our neighborhood got all excited, and pretty soon, you know, there was quite a public outroar over that one because to put it that close to a state park was just seemed like they were kind of rubbing their noses in it or something. And so that got me kind of going. And, you know, after 30 years at the DNR, I've still been involved with CAFOs the whole time because I'm concerned about those natural resources and how these are affecting that. And so I've been pursuing it. I've been to, I can't believe how many Board of Supervisors meetings I've been to, and I've testified before the Department of Natural Resources Commission, things like that. I went to a lot of public meetings. I've worked with other organizations, public organizations, either fighting these or just trying to get more information.
I have heard that the DNR makes the last decision, and that they approve almost all. Only 2% have they not approved. Do you know anything about the ones who weren't approved?
I really don't, but I'd be really curious because I wonder how they got just 2% to not be legit. But I think some of the producers backed out over the public outcry, too. So I don't know if that's included in the 2% or not.
Well, you said that basically the DNR is in the same situation as the supervisors. They can disapprove, but then it'll happen anyway as long as the matrix is.
Yeah, and I think a little bit of history helps with understanding that because that's what I learned being in the DNR for 30 years is that when I started, it was called the Conservation Commission, and it was a group of people made decisions about things. And so there was that change came along there in the late 80s where we changed to the Department of Natural Resources, and that became a straight-down hierarchy of where the governor appointed the head of the DNR. And then during the political climate, as time went on, they replaced administrative heads to align with that political philosophy. So it became more of a political decision-making thing following the recommendations of the governor and stuff. So that changed everything of how we evaluate things. And so the people in the DNR, you know, I know them personally. Their hearts are in it. You know, it's not that. But, boy, it's become a political entity in a lot of ways and very hierarchical when it wasn't before. So.
Well, as we get back to the meeting, mm-hmm. what was your impression of the meeting?
Well, it's been really interesting to me. And we'll go into detail about the specifics of that particular meeting. But I've been to so many of these. You begin to see the similarities, and you begin to have a lot more empathy for all the people there, even the individual farmer, because you hear these personal stories of, you know, their livelihood. They've been doing this for generations. And so you begin to kind of see where they're each coming from. And that brings me, you know, to the idea of, well, how do I make sense of all these? How do I, give credence to each one of these people? And still, how do we talk about where we want to live? How do we talk about the community? How do we define the community that we're in? What are the values that we use to do that with?
Well, there's must be more than one community, right?
Oh, yeah. That's where it gets really interesting. I think, you know, if you get down to the individual level and you look at, say, take it from the producer or the farmer's perspective, you know, that's one position. And then you look at more the common good is at the other end of that continuum of, you know, who gets included in there. And, you know, that gets into property rights. You know, it's my property. I can do what I want. You know, we get into all those issues with air quality affecting the neighbors that are close. And we're attempting to address those concerns of each person. But the way things are written, it kind of just isn't working out too well that way. So that's what we're going to hopefully talk about in a little bit more detail today.
Yeah,
so.
Well, as our regular listeners may know, there in Thursday's slot for the Heart of Iowa, Ursula had edited quite a bit of Pat's recordings of the testimony, and I pulled some of those out knowing what you might want to talk about. And so what do you think was the best summary statement?
Well, that's good. I really went back and reviewed what has been on KHOI, because you've had a number of programs lately about this issue, which I think is great. We're not getting this kind of depth of understanding of what's going on anywhere else. So, I have to put everything in a little bit larger context. So, and I think who summed it up the best was Margaret Say Janes, who works in the Department of Health and Environment in the Story County thing. And she, was in a very difficult position in that she's employed, but she has personal feelings. And I can relate to that because that's how I was in the DNR. It was really hard for me a lot of times, depending on the issues. So when she came up, she made a list of, she had to talk about it two different ways, one from her job and...
We have that clip. Can we hear that online?
And next I have Margaret Janes, representing Margaret Janes.
What I'm hearing is antibiotics, hormones, toxins, flies, water quality, air quality, flooding, property value, density, animal welfare, and community development. All of those things are not reflected in that master matrix, not one thing. Today's meeting has been very long. But today was good in that we could compare the process for housing development and the process for animal confinement. The process is laughable. The differences in the process is laughable. I think it's totally wrong. Okay? Now, as far as changing the score in that, I mean, that would keep this process alive. In my opinion, it's very easy to score these things. It's an exercise in checking boxes for the most part. Okay? There's not a lot of hoops and things that they have to go through. If you lived, karst topography or somewhere where it's a lot more difficult to get the spacing, then an master matrix might work. But around here, just about anybody could put in a confinement with enough work. So I don't think changing the score at this point is really an option. I think that all those things pass fine close. I think that the Board of Supervisors need to vote to deny the approval of the application And that way, the process doesn't die for these three cables. If you send a passing score and a passing recommendation, it's going in, period. It's going in. If you send a passing score but denial based on comments, then it's still alive, and we could get more discussion and more attention from our legislators to know that this is not working. These comments, there's no way they show up on the master matrix, and it's just not data. I don't think we have the science to support these things going in, and I think that we need to really put the brakes. Thank you.
Well, there's a good example of a public employee in a tight spot.
Yes. She was on last week and when she explained how the matrix worked.
Yes.
And she wanted to make sure that that she was able to say that the supervisors had no – they probably would not – would approve it because that was the law. And then, and actually we can hear what the supervisors said in their closing when they voted because they didn't – it wasn't unanimous.
Right. But I think, you know, that's what I see at every one of these meetings is that there's a process set up and there's a lot of frustrated people there. We're even within the government positions or the Board of Supervisors, it is always being expressed that this is not working. This is – something is wrong here. And that says a lot about, you know, government and how are we going to address these issues. And I you know, once it gets a certain score, the Board of Supervisors, it goes to the DNR. It's already approved in a way because then they just have to make sure that they got that score. And so it came back to, I think a lot of the people were hoping that we would step back from doing the scoring and just talk about why the master matrix process is not working. And she expressed that very well, I thought.
Well, yes, but I was a little surprised at how many people said, try to rescore it. Well, I couldn't see how that would be possible because, as she said, that's the way it's structured.
Exactly.
You can't rescore it. Just say, well, we'll take some points off here. No?
No. Well, and she said it, you know, I don't think people caught quite how well she said it. She's had to hear every little piece of this, and she made a list of all the different issues. Not one of them, she says, is are you able to score in the master matrix?
Yes.
Not one is addressed. So yes. That about sums it up for me. You know, what's the point?
Yeah, but she did mention something else that we didn't take the time to explain. The reason that the hearing started so late, which was after 11 o'clock, supposed to start at 10, and people who got there at 9:30, there were no seats left. But the reason it was so late was that they had a zoning, a development out east of
Gilbert,
the Eagle Ridge, I think. And it was – actually, it was a model development because it was very good use of the land. I mean, it was densely packed. Mm-hmm. So you didn't have these great big, 10-acre plots. Mm-hmm. You had – and they you know, had set aside the sensitive areas – that's the slope, which I think they couldn't – and it was – it had a lot of floodplain in it, and it had some of the prairie they were building into, but they had a portion.
Right.
And I think you have more criticisms of that plan than I do. But anyway, to get back to it, that was very carefully discussed and, you know, on the merits,
right,
of the plan.
That's a good point.
Rather than, right, you know, this irrelevance matrix that says, you know, are you so many feet from
right,
a waterway or whatever.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, it was – I saw the two issues tied together, and we can talk about them in similar ways, again, about how do we define what community is. I mean, and they talked about half-acre plots for the houses or acre plots and, you know, all those kind of details, but they didn't talk about the plot in itself. So it's right on that watershed, that Squaw Creek. And, you know, when we're talking about water quality and we're talking about prairie and buffer strips and all those for farmland, we want to be talking about that where we're building houses too. You know, we're developing those last little pieces that are left.
Yes. Well, someone who I know pretty well from environmental work said that actually the agricultural land has more runoff than a well-planned. Of course, and the other thing, though, is if you have lawns, then you have more nitrates than if you
have. Well, and it's kind of the joke about, you know, we always take what's left and then we divide it up and we're going to do this great planning, you know, and we call it environmental and green, but we're still always dividing it up and developing more. And I was known as, you know, the most biologically altered state in North America. We've already devoted 98% to agriculture and roads and cities. How long can you keep going this way? You know, that's my question. So. Well, and there's a lot of other issues that we could get into, and I think, you know, that's what I kind of see a spectrum of how people come into these processes. There's kind of a, you know, they come in as an individual. So the CAFO is going in beside me, and I'm going to have to smell it, and you know, I can't hang my laundry on the line. And then you can go, you know, all the way to the other end about long-term planning, which was brought up, and about how much Story County is putting into long-range planning and watershed development.
Yeah, that was Loris's comment. Can we play Loris' conclusion there?
Yeah, we will close the public hearing, and board, now it is our time. Believe that our responsibility was to gather feedback and go through the process of gathering feedback, and it's no fun at all for the Henrys, for sure, but it's part of the process for us to get through. So with that, I'll turn, Loris, I'll start with you. Comments from anything we've heard, or do you want to hold those for when we get to each one?
I was born in Iowa, in North Iowa. I was a townie. I had uncles who farmed and for kids. I eat pork. Third version, strategic plan that tried to balance agriculture with growth needs. I thought about the comprehensive two cornerstone plan. And I thought about some of the restoration work going on at Hickory Grove, etc. So I thought a lot about this. And in each one of those, either a previous board of supervisors or we up here spent your money. The majority, we spent your money. And I think that until there's work on the master matrix, until maybe after the first of the year, a new board discusses possibility, how they might want to weigh in down at the state, I'm going to vote to deny. Based upon, not the Henrys, because I'm really impressed, and not upon the other people who are here opened up and shared with me some of their confinement operations, etc. But I'm going to vote to deny, because how can we put so many hundreds of thousands of dollars between what we spent on consultants and what our staff time cost, etc., to keep moving forward on planning in the county when we can be set askew by a local family coming in and wanting to raise 15,000 hogs times two. I'm going to vote to deny because of that.
Okay. Anything else?
Nothing.
Thank you, Loris. Marty.
Well, there was a good example of, and I appreciated how she started out and said, you know, I eat pork. And we all kind of find ourselves in these moral dilemmas because it isn't cut and dry. And that's what I see each time I go to these meetings, of these personal, heartfelt things expressed by each person. And they're not attacking someone else. They're just saying how it affects me. And so that's kind of the part of government that I thought she captured so well, is we need to look a little long term. We need to do some planning and understand our place in a larger community. And so I kind of leaned towards that. I was very impressed with her. And I think it also illustrated somewhat what's going on our national level of politics, too, because this kind of ran right through. They filed these three CAFO applications all at once, and the board is about to change here come January 1st. I don't think the vote would have went the same way if they'd have waited till the new person was put on.
No, Linda Merkin was one of the people who testified, and she testified for looking at the matrix again and trying to rescore it. But, of course, that didn't, as I said before, that didn't seem practical to me. And, incidentally, we won't have time to play what Martin Schitte and Rick Sanders said, but basically it was, this is the law. We swore to follow the law, and we don't say pick and choose which laws we want to follow. This is the law that we have.
Right, right.
And
You know, and that's the thing about laws and you know, politics. Once things become political, you know, it takes away from both the individual, understanding the individual's position, and the collective community of where we live. And we're trying to address that by law, but this is quite clear that we've been doing this for – I've been involved for 30 years. It's been going on longer than that, and it's going to go on a lot longer. So.
Yep, and we have – Mary Rankin coming in just a minute, and so we have time either to hear from the Nevada City Council or from a child's letter that was shall we hear from the council? What do you say? What do you vote?
The city council and Nevada, this is directly going to impact the city, but then we go back down to the individual, the child.
So
and.
Okay, maybe
both
we
of them are
play them both. Okay, start with the
statements.
Council and end with the.
Good afternoon, Board of Supervisors. My name is Matt Hardison. I am the City Administrator for the City of Nevada, Iowa. I have been asked by Mayor Barker and the Nevada City Council to summarize what was at our public forum last night at the City of Nevada Council meeting. Overall themes of those that spoke are exactly what we've heard here today: air quality and water, future economic development in Nevada. Concerns for future housing development in the north side. I'm not sure if that's one that's been discussed. A decrease in property tax valuations and home values, increased damage to roads in the area, concern of proximity to the wasteland applications near the city of Nevada, and concerns about monitoring the facility that plans are being followed under the authority of the Iowa DNR. In addition to that, I've been asked by Mayor Barker to read a statement. He was unable to be here today. So I will go ahead with his statement quoting from Mr. Mayor Barker. As a city has no governing authority over this process, it has been a challenge issuing for the city to address. Like the coal yard proposal of 10 years ago, I have concerns about any project that could limit future development in our city or impact property values or quality of life for our residents. Unfortunately, the master matrix system appears significantly limit the ability of local governments to have input in the process. The system is outdated and does not reflect modern agriculture, and it de-incentivizes farmers who work for local leaders collaboratively, and it does not give adequate time for communities to have the types of conversations these types of proposals would warrant. Additionally, there are members of our community passionately concerned about air and water quality. Unfortunately, we must trust our local farmers and the Iowa DNR to provide proper oversight, as city staff does not have the expertise or the authority to manage those concerns. The Henry family has valued members of the Nevada community for generations. However, I feel this process of the matrix systems does both the family and our community a disservice. End of the statement from Mr. Barker. I've been asked by the council to relay several of their concerns. Mr. Walker has addressed the concern of me with the property value and expansion of our housing market, which is in dire need of improving into the city of Nevada. So his concern is the housing market and the economic development impact that could have. My professional thoughts are this. I look at it from a housing perspective. I do have concerns about limitations of future housing expansion within the city limits of Nevada. Having worked on a project already that has been drug on for almost the entire time I've been here for 2 years, it's disheartening that we're not making progress on that, so we're really limited as to the expansion of housing outside the city limits. So that is a concern of mine as a city administrator moving forward. Thank you for listening.
When I went to bed last night, I received this letter on my pillow from my 11-year-old son. I would like to read it into the record. Dear government, why are you destroying my creek property with the pollution of thousands of hogs? Does it really benefit our lives? If so, how? Will I really never get to play in my creek again, never get to chase and catch minnows again? Do I have to start treating my creek as a biohazard? My family and I would wade up and down the creek in the summer. We would laugh and play, splash each other, and swim. Will you really take that joy, that happiness, that tradition of playing there away? Why? Sincerely, Paul Stevens, Grade 5, Nevada Middle School.
Thank you, Mark, for being with me and for allowing us to talk about these issues that came out of the supervisors' meeting.
I love the radio station for getting in depth into these issues. So thank you for having me.
And this is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people's stories and events in central Iowa. Mark Edwards and I have been summing up the issues raised in the Story County Board of Supervisors meeting last Tuesday, when nearly 40 citizens spoke, either supporting or opposing the siting of 3,000 hog confinements just north of Nevada. And for an upbeat ending, we have Mary Rankin and her guest, Steve Coates.
Correct.
Here to talk about, well, I'll let you tell us, Mary.
Good morning. Hi. It's lovely to be here as always. Well, we thought we would come and talk about the holiday season. We're certainly in the middle of the holiday season, but we're still ramping up for a couple few holidays yet to come. And there are so many things to celebrate, of course, every year. And we just wanted to maybe offer a little sustainability flair toward the holidays. So we have a few different things to talk about related to the holidays and making your holidays just a little bit more sustainable. And from a standpoint of the three facets of sustainability that we talk about, the environmental sustainability, the social sustainability, and the economic sustainability.
Okay. And incidentally, I didn't introduce you properly.
Oh, my goodness, you're fine.
This is Mary Rankin, Sustainability Coordinator for both Iowa State University and the City of Ames. So we are going to be sustainable this holiday season, right?
Exactly. Exactly. That is indeed my intent in all that I do, is how can we be a little bit more sustainable? And, of course, I look at myself as well. So for all the listeners, it's not just about them. It's always a lifelong journey for myself. And we even have more sustainability in the room today because my official title at Iowa State is Director of Sustainability. And so we have a wonderful opportunity this year in having a sustainability coordinator also at Iowa State. And Steve Coates is in that role.
Oh.
Yes. And so among other things, I guess we could really boil down his responsibilities to say that he's my right hand, my right arm, the right side of my body, and about a third of my brain most days. So and incredibly talented in all that he does. And it's just fabulous to have him with us.
Well, and now we need to find out what you do that's where Mary lets off and you take it, carry it out.
So I'm kind of the coordinator for the program at ISU. And so we have a variety of interns that I oversee and help Mary manage. We work together to put together a newsletter that comes out once a month. And it's called the Live Green Monthly. The newsletter is also something that really focuses on sustainable activities on campus in the Ames community and around the world. It's kind of exciting to offer those opportunities. And then we also have an events coordinating team. They're marketing communication team. And they develop opportunities for the campus to learn more about being sustainable and ways to do that.
And, of course, this year's our 10-year anniversary for the Live Green initiative at Iowa State. So we have monthly events, monthly blog posts, social media campaigns, and just awareness about the many different areas of sustainability that Iowa State has been working very hard toward and been very dedicated around. And Steve has been helping a lot with coordinating all those moving pieces. So see, he is a third of my brain.
Well, I presume we're not going to be talking about all the different sustainability, like what you do with the waste from the food service, right?
Correct.
That's I used to know somebody who worked in that, and that's huge. And and the attitudes of students when they're like scraping their trays. And that was a long time ago when my granddaughter was a student that I heard about that. And just the, you know, the food service alone, the foods that are planned and so forth.
Right.
So you have
That's one facet of it, most definitely.
Right, but what's the facet that has to do with the holidays?
Well, we're actually going to talk way beyond campus, certainly campus is included. But we wanted to just give folks some indication of the impact we make during the holidays, right? So, first of all, if we look at economic sustainability, Steve, do you want to offer a few of these interesting facts?
Yeah, so there's been a variety of different studies that we hear about how much an American's going to spend for the holidays and that. This year, it's gone up 4%, and so it's averaged that an American is going to spend about $967 per person. So I would spend that in my holiday season for different gifts and food and a variety of things like that. But they've broke it down into states even, and they're saying that an Iowan would be spending $916.45 this year on Christmas or holiday traditions.
How do they calculate that? Because I would imagine there are some people who aren't spending as much as they did last year.
Correct. Yeah. In fact, they said that an average adult plans to spend $419 but goes over budget due to just the heartstrings and different things being pulled at the time. This is calculated, I believe, by taking the national expenditures and then dividing them up accordingly by state and different things like that. Yeah. So,
Well, obviously, if it's 800 or 900, it's still an awful lot of money and more than most people budget for the rest of the year. I know that this keeps a lot of businesses alive.
Yes.
Of course. And the thing is that, you know, we bring up the economic impact because if we're spending this, if we're you know, putting this money forth, and we're taking it, you know, from other things that we would be spending them on in our own homes, then we want to just be mindful on how we're spending them, and is there that opportunity that you sort of give twice, right, when you spend your money, and how you spend your money in general. And so with that, we wanted to also bring up that along with the amount of expenditures, we produce a lot of waste. And so the two, you know, sort of go hand in hand as you're looking at how are you spending your money. And as you are making those expenditures, if you have items that are, you know, left over or those sorts of things, what can be done with them rather than you just sort of feeling like you have that big expenditure and then it's in your garbage can the next day sort of thing. So every year our waste actually during the holidays between Thanksgiving and New Year's, our waste stream increases by 25% in the country. So we put that much more garbage in the waste stream. And a couple of interesting facts related to that is, again, thinking of what do you put in your garbage? Does it really need to go in your garbage? So things like holiday wrapping and holiday ribbon and those sorts of things. If, for example, every person decided that they were going to wrap three of their gifts in upcycled materials that could be reused for something else or materials that you knew could be readily recycled or disposed of, not necessarily having to go into your garbage. If that happened, we would actually save enough wrapping paper that would cover 45,000 football fields. And that's just in America. And so as everybody is at the Alamo Bowl, we may think about, wow, 45,000 of these could be covered. You know, if we just wrapped three gifts, just of the mini gifts we have, just three of them and other types of things. If a family reused just 2 feet of holiday ribbon that you wrap around packages, we would save 38,000 miles of ribbon. That would actually be enough to go around the planet and tie a big bow. And so these are some of the things that as we look at how we're spending our money, we can just be conscientious of those particular purchases and maybe not be spending them on things that are only going to make then an environmental impact, if that makes sense.
I can hardly wait to talk about my favorite way of wrapping. We get the stick-on bows, mm-hmm. and we, you know, plan. Now, this is a stick-on bow we want to keep for next year. You can have it if you, you know.
I love that. Yeah. We do that at my family as well. And how many times the next year you have a little loop of tape, right? Because the stickiness has gone out of the original sticky bow, but you just keep using it and using and using it again. Most definitely. My family absolutely gets so very exhausted of being around me when I'm unwrapping gifts, because I'm the person that takes 5 minutes to make sure that I can reuse the paper the next year if we're using paper. And I can't remember the last time we bought wrapping paper, actually. Now my family just knows to give me their wrapping paper, and so they don't have to worry about it. But we do some other really unique things, I think, that we can consider for wrapping. For example, we have little gifts that we give the team every year around the holidays. And this year we went out and Steve actually was responsible for this, but went out and chose a unique cloth napkin for each of the team members that then they could use throughout the year, and that would allow them to not have that additional waste from using a disposable napkin. We can do, you know, tea towels. You can actually get a storage container for your kitchen, put items in there and put a bow on top of it. And then you can even take newspaper, magazines, those sorts of things that then you can put in your recycling bin when you're done with them. And it just allows that that environmental sustainability to not have so much impact.
Well, the one that is really bugging me now is the cardboard boxes that things come in.
Mm-hmm. A lot of overpackaging.
That's
right.
And it's also a little plug for shopping local.
Absolutely. If you shop local, you don't have to worry about all the overpackaging. There's other ways that you can gift as well. And in fact, we just did a display at the Memorial Union all about thinking about gratitude in your gifting and not necessarily just needing to give things. If you do want to give things, support your local businesses. But there's other ways that you can provide gifts. Do you want to talk about some of those ways, Steve? Because
sure.
You came up with such great ideas with the team.
Well, I don't know about great ideas, but
they were.
Some of the ideas were spending time, so offering coupons that you could go for a walk with a loved one or a friend, walking their dog or a pet, spending time with family or babysitting while someone goes out and takes some opportunity to do some self-sustainability as well. Were a couple of ideas. Gifting things that are not single use, but something that can be reused over and over. So an opportunity might be, like Mary mentioned, some containers that they can reuse, like the napkins that we use to tie or to wrap with. They can use those over and over. And we've actually had some students talk about how they have special napkins that they carry with them and use them throughout the year and have special memories of how those are offered. Some other opportunities were maybe being just a little bit creative. And so taking hot cocoa, maybe it's a favorite drink of someone's, and putting it together and making a Christmas tree out of it. So instead of just offering it in the wrapping of a box, you're offering a new way to gift it without it being packaged so much, and an opportunity to offer a different look to the packaging, as well as we made some, took a pillow from the inside. So, you know, you just get a basic pillow form and write on the pillow some of your personal thoughts, and then they can wrap it into a pillowcase and you don't see it, but you know that it's there. So the one suggested that this person had hugged the pillow, and every time that you hug the pillow, it's kind of like you're squeezing each other back and forth. So it's kind of a unique idea.
And really inexpensive, these ideas. But as you mentioned, if it is something that you want to go out and you want to purchase something that someone is really interested in, buying from local businesses really supports our local economy as well. You don't have that environmental impact because of the reduced packaging. And there are different businesses as well that your purchase actually gives back to someone else. So I'm just coming up with a couple of them. We're right across from the Octagon. Purchasing items at the Octagon gives back to our local artists, of course. Worldly Goods gives back to artisans all over the world. If you go buy a membership at Ryman Gardens, you, of course, give back to the gardens, as well as allowing folks, you know, the opportunity to enjoy the gardens. Of course, Iowa State Center, some of those shows. Actors, some of those shows. We're giving back to the arts in our community. So those lists go on and on and on versus just going somewhere and maybe buying something that, you know, might not be as interesting in a couple of months.
You didn't mention one of my favorites, and that's the alternative gift market, which will
absolutely.
Be down at Wheatsfield.
Yes.
And in fact, all of my grandchildren are now over 20.
Mm-hmm.
And so And I never know what to get them. And so for the last couple of years, I've been sending them cards from the alternative gift market, a bicycle for a local doctor in Kenya. Or so you pick your country, you pick your project, whether it's an animal or sometimes it's education to school fees.
That's a fabulous idea. We put that in our newsletter. We just forgot to mention it on the air.
Well, I figured you had it. But I wanted to tell you, I decided to call them this year and say, please don't give us any gifts. We have everything. And don't bother to go shopping. One granddaughter said, well, that's the best gift of all. And the other one said, I always like it when you give something in my name. I always feel, you know, good about that.
They're lovely ideas. And even just cooking a big meal, you know, saying, okay, we're going to, different people are going to host different meals throughout the year, and you can come and enjoy meals together. You're exactly right. I know a few of the students on our team have actually done what they call reverse advent calendars, where every day in December they actually put something into a box to donate to the local food bank or local organization in need. And so they're giving the gift, and then the gift to them is being able to give back to their community. So there's so many really unique ideas. I think we just get so caught up in there's some really good commercials out there, and believe me, I'm a sucker for those good commercials. They pull my heartstrings. However, that being said, I think there are so many ways that we can really embrace the holidays and embrace each other and all the wonderful things we have in our community versus necessarily just going out and getting those impulse gifts. Another thing, there is the idea of holiday trees. And we did some research, and so the interesting thing is there's of course point counterpoint any type of consumption that you're going to do. One of the best ways to consider purchasing a tree, particularly if you want to purchase a live tree, is purchasing it local, supporting a local farmer. The way that holiday trees are grown, they're grown in order to be replenished. And so there is certainly an environmental impact, but it's also done in a way that the trees are replenished, they're able to be enjoyed. At the end of the use of that particular holiday tree, we actually prop ours up in the backyard, give the birds some extra cover, and then we are able to get it mulched. For those folks who wouldn't necessarily need to use that, the city has a free mulching program for Christmas trees that folks can actually go on the city's website. I actually sent the link to Ursula as well, so you might be able to put that on your website. But that is a free service for the community of being able to not have those, you know, having a beneficial use for those trees. If you do, do you want to talk about the artificial trees, Steve?
Sure. First of all, also some things you can do with your real tree is, if you're a crafter, cut the branches off and chop the trunk up and make them into half-inch slabs, and you can use them as coasters or different things throughout your house.
Yes.
You can simply dry them out by putting them into an oven at 140 degrees, 70 degrees, and for 2 to 3 hours, and it'll dry out the sap and everything like that.
So that's a very important number to remember.
Yes.
Not too much.
No. Yeah, exactly. So that's an opportunity. Or drill a hole at the top of it and make it into an ornament for next year. Name tags are something we use a lot with those little wood
discs. You can spell out fun words and string them all together around your tree and
things.
Home.
But anyway, back to the artificial tree. If you're getting rid of your artificial tree, some things to think about is how much life is left in it. If there's a lot of life still in it, you can donate that to a different organization or Goodwill or someplace where someone can have a second life with that tree.
Bring them to Rummage Rampage.
Yeah,
we have holiday trees at Rummage Rampage as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can start breaking the tree apart. So you could use it, some branches in artificial centerpieces for the next year. I've even seen where people take the fronds of the tree and use them for tie, zip ties, or, you know, like a quick tie. Even I've seen in shops, men's carpentry shops and that kind of stuff, where they've used the branches to tie up power cords and different things like that. So instead of just throwing the tree away and getting rid of it into the landfill, you can reuse it in a variety of different ways.
Right.
I'd love to tell my favorite way to use an artificial tree.
I'd love to hear.
Please.
Well, the person who originally gave me this idea denies it, so I think she's ashamed of it. But I think it was so neat. So what it is I put all the lights and all of my ornaments that I have been literally collecting for the last 50 years.
Uh-huh.
And adding in one or two each year.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like our tree.
And then at the end of the season, I wrap it in a sheet and store it. It used to be in the basement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the hardest part was carrying it up without it fall coming apart, putting it there. No needles on the floor. And I used to say, you know, this is our tradition. This is Grandma's tree. It's the same every year.
It's nice to have those traditions. Absolutely.
Yeah. That was always my favorite way to use the old Christmas tree.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Mm-hmm. Well, and if you do a comparison in buying an artificial tree versus having, you know, purchasing a real tree every year, the return on investment, so to speak, for having the artificial tree is about 5 years. You know, so if you have that versus buying a real tree for 5 years, mm-hmm. you have virtually given yourself an offset mm-hmm. of the impact, the environmental impact of having the artificial tree. So that's sort of how that number mm-hmm. goes. Mm-hmm. I know folks are interested in that. And then you can just have alternative trees where you have neither a real or an artificial, but you make a tree, maybe out of a lot of books. Maybe you take I know I used to do this when I lived in an apartment. I had a Norfolk spruce in a pot, and I would just decorate one of my plants. So there's a few different ways that you can still celebrate the holidays without necessarily having a tree properly.
Well, thank you. This has been delightful, but it's time that we need to say goodbye.
All right. Thanks. Well, we would just say get on our website, livegreen.iastate.edu. We have a Pinterest link and account, and we've got all these different ideas on there.
Well,
and happy sustainable holidays.
Thank you so much. This is KHOI Community Radio. You've been listening to Local Talk, where we explore the people's stories and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host for today, Susan Franzen, and Mark Edwards has been my co-host. Other voices you heard were Dennis Hart, Margaret Janes, Matthew Marsden, Mary Bankin, and Steve Coates. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. There are also rebroadcasts of this morning's show at noon and 7 p.m. Local Talk was engineered by Aladdin. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was The Happy Farmer by Robert Schumann. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878 or through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to do to support our community. And contact us if you want to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for the yellow donate button. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes in part from the Ames Alternative Gift Market this Christmas season, available 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on December 8th and December 15th at the Wheatsfield Cooperative Grocery, 413 Northwestern Avenue in Ames. This event is an opportunity to learn about and support charitable projects around the world as well as in our own community. Learn more at alternativegifts.org.